Welcome to another episode of Systematic Geekology. This is a space where we seek to create and cultivate healthy conversations between those things we geek out on and the philosophical and theological questions that often arise out of our fandoms. Like, what does it mean to be human? What makes a hero? What makes a villain? How do the stories and narratives we geek out on shape how we live in the world? We are your priest to the geeks. We aren't all ordained, but we see ourselves as mediators at the intersection of geek culture and going deeper in our faith. We don't always have to agree, but we do respect each other, and we see everyone as a beloved child of God. Everyone geeks out on something, so come geek out with us and enjoy the show.
You're listening to an Anazal Ministries podcast.
The censorship have a place within the comics medium? We're going to ask that question and plenty more today on Systematic Geekology. We are the priest of the geeks. I'm your host, Christian Ashley, as we're going through our primarily political series. But I couldn't possibly do this alone. I have a friend here, a very valued friend, Kevin Schaefer. How's it going, Kevin?
Christian, I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm okay, man. It's one of those days, like I said earlier before we were recording, just getting up earlier than I want, but it's all right. Got through it, got paid for it at that too. So it makes it even better.
Hey, that helps. But it is Monday for sure, but this is a good way to kind of like at least close out my day for me as a good podcast here. So I'm excited.
Oh, yeah. Well, as part of this series, one of the questions we're asking, in addition to everything else, is what do you have a favorite political figure? Could be from real life or fandom, just in general.
Do I have one? I was thinking about it. It'll tie into a question later. As far as real life, I do like Beto O'Rourke, even though he hasn't like succeeded in winning like positions I wanted, like he ran for governor last year, but he's the out of like politicians today, he's the kind of guy I could see like just having a conversation with and that I would align with view wise. But I'll also bring him up in a question later in the episode. As far as I'm trying to think of like fictional ones because usually they're villains. So you got a good one there, but that would be my for like real life. But,
yeah. Okay. Yeah. I've answered this question multiple times, so I think I'm just gonna, instead of coming up with one other person, I'm just gonna skip it this time around. So
I'll just say, well, okay, like granted, not like full politician, but basically. But Professor X is essentially like a key world leader and a political figure in his world. Not without his flaws, of course, but as far as like the kind of leader I would want, you know, in especially in this day and age or really any, that would be my favorite like fictional one.
Excellent choice. All right, guys. As we mentioned before, this is in our primarily political series, going through the politics of our fandoms, how they intersect, and how they intersect with the real world. This is going to be primarily more of a real world thing, and that we're discussing the Comics Code Authority. Now, this is something that is very, as in its creation, would not exist if it were not politically charged. But before that, before we head into that, Kevin, what have you been geeking out on recently?
Well, I have seen Dune Part 2 twice, and it is one like, you know, we did the Godzilla Minus One episode, and we kind of all agreed that like there's some movies you've got to see on the big screen. I mean, I'm a theater connoisseur in general, but you got to see Dune on there. It is just like a modern cinematic masterpiece. I mean, the first one's great, but story-wise, it's very expositional. This one gets more into the meat of the story and Paul's ascension to being this like world leader and his relationship with the Fremen. It is just excellent all around. So if you have not seen it, highly recommend.
Excellent movie, excellent story. I'm going to go completely opposite route. I just started a new anime, well, new to me, it came out in the 70s, called Ryu Primitive Boy or something like that. It's basically in a mishmash world where dinosaurs and cavemen are around. This one boy was cast out of his tribe because he had different colored skin compared to everyone else, and they took that as a bad omen. He was raised by a gorilla and is now trying to find his mother, who was trying to find him, and they've kind of like crossed paths a couple of times without realizing it. So there's that. It's a really fun series so far. Looking forward to more. But you didn't come here for Ryu, Primitive Boy. You came here for the Comics Code Authority. Now, Kevin, can you explain how the Comics Code was created, how it evolved? We'll work it together on this one. We'll workshop it.
Yeah, for sure. So I first heard about the Comics Code Authority and Legacy Street in, there was a comic book documentary I watched. I don't know the name of it. It was just kind of one of those general like History Channel specials kind of thing when I was a kid. So you can tell I was always a nerd about this stuff and anything with pop culture history. So that's when I first learned about it. And essentially what it is in the mid 20th century, there was a massive fear about the effect that comics were having on children, on culture as a whole. And in particular, there was a book published called Seduction of the Innocent by Friedrich Wertheim, he was a psychologist, and he was very much of the mind that comics were causing kids to become delinquents, and there was a correlation between kids reading comics and either violent crimes, addictions, and even like with superhero comics, he was saying that there was a direct link between this and then kids who, you know, tried to fly and end up, you know, being killed in the process. Like, granted, those stories were one in a million, he took those as justification for this book, saying these, you know, are fantasies that are corrupting society and children. And so this had a massive effect. And so the Comics Code Authority was institutionalized, and it forced all comics publishers to censor everything. And I'm not just talking like, oh, make it more PG-13. This like eliminated horror comics, eliminated a ton of supernatural stuff. It prevented any comics from portraying villains with any kind of empathy. You know, like it was very much like these had to be very straightforward, moral, ambiguity, like good guy always wins, and there was nothing controversial. And so that's in a gist. I don't know what you want to add to that, but that's the overview there.
I mean, that's the best way to put it. You asked like, how did I learn about it? It's one of those things that, you know, it's always been on the comics that I read, but I never cared about that portion because I was like, oh, cool cover. You know, Spider-Man and Iron Man are fighting this villain, or, you know, Batman's fighting this villain. You know, yeah, that's what I want to see inside the issue. So I would look at a cover, cool cover. Let's get to the story. Then later on, you know, I think I was reading, it's one of those books they put out, I think, in the 90s, like covering like the history of Marvel Comics as a whole. And it mentioned the Comics Code Authority in regards to something we'll be discussing later on here with Amazing Spider-Man 96 through 98, where there was this whole controversy of Stan Lee had been asked by people, we'll get to exactly who later on, to portray drugs in a negative way. But as hardcore as the Comics Code Authority was, even a negative portrayal of drugs was too much for them. Mm-hmm. So Lee took it off. And once again, we'll get to more of that. So that's how I was introduced to the concept. And as what you said here, yeah, Wertheim, charitably speaking, I can say he's someone who cared about children. It came at that time, you know, McCarthyism is a big thing right now in the American sphere. It's like, you know, who's a hidden communist around me? Have they infiltrated Congress? Well, I need to prove I'm a red-blooded American. And one way I can do that is attaching myself to ideas like this, where it seems like our children are learning the wrong things here. They're learning, you know, about the grotesque side of life, or there's this panel of Dick Grayson and Bruce Wayne in the same bed, and therefore they must be a homosexual couple, you know, instead of anything innocent. And which is one of the examples he actually uses in the book proper as like, hey, this is what they're coming for your children. And it's all this stuff here kind of mixed together that comes from a good place and the idea of, hey, like kids are young. They don't need to be coddled, I think they really wanted them to be coddled, but that you can't introduce them in the same way that you don't introduce an elementary student to, you know, high level calculus. You start with 2 + 2 = 4. In the other aspects of the world, you got to start, okay, here's violence between superheroes and supervillains. And then like, oh, here's why maybe the villain got into villainy or something like that. You can introduce that later on and you can have these deeper concepts. But charitably speaking, I think they came from a good place, but their follow through is what I really have an issue with. So go ahead with what you're about to say.
I agree that, because I was watching a video earlier and I think it's easy to think of Wordrum as this cartoonish villain, but you're right. Like the intentions behind what he did were very much like he wanted to portray an anti-violence message and, you know, help children. And so it came from a good place. Granted, it like we'll get into it, but it's like way overkill. And it had its effect. But like, if they ever make a movie about, you know, like a Stanley biopic or do something with comics history into that, you know, I do think they can, you know, it'd be easy to write Wordrum in just this like one scene as just this like character. But really he did, I agree that he did come from with good intentions, but then it kind of spiraled from there. And the book, you know, and I don't agree with what it is like, because I mean, you could also relate like Comics Code Authority to, you know, like the D&D scare in the 80s or in the modern age, like saying, oh, violent video games, you know, cause havoc. You know, I mean, like, it's like, yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of, we'll get into all of that in this discussion, but yeah.
There's always something else other than parental authority that is causing the downgrading of children's minds, you know. It's video games, just too violent. We just can't have them playing those Grand Theft Auto games. And yeah, sure, you know, an 8-year-old probably shouldn't be playing Grand Theft Auto. But, you know, for a mature kid, sure, let them have at it. Let them learn some life lessons through that game. You know, and comics are the same way. It's like, it's a great way to explore these fictional concepts. You can have these larger-than-life heroes come in and protect the world from threats that, hey, maybe they started off from a bad place and they wanted to change the world. They wanted to be a hero at some point in time. And you give them a little depth there, but then they changed along the way or what have you here. Or maybe you just want to have a really scary story, which maybe, you know, little Billy at 6 years old shouldn't be reading, but someone else who appreciates that can, you know. I, at 6 years old, wouldn't have appreciated reading EC Comics. You know why? Because I wasn't ready for it. You know, as I am now, I can read them totally fine. You know, I still get scared, but in a way different way than I would have when I was 6 and be traumatized and never read any comic again for the rest of my life. You know, there are boundaries. Every child is different. And I think instead of being nuanced about it, they just said, nope, we're going to have this whole thing just leveled out. No one gets it. And it came from the place. This is not a government mandated thing, though. This was actually created by the different comic industries to say, look, instead of having the government down our throats and looking over our backs, why don't we just rule and govern ourselves? So you have representatives from Marvel/Atlas at the time. You have representatives from DC and EC and Harvey and Archie and all that working together for that common purpose of, let's make sure they don't shut us down and we lose money. So we'll make these rules in effect to protect ourselves.
And it's funny because it's like, I'd have to look at individual companies and stuff, how they fare during that. But like the flip side is like DC Comics and others that were known for horror and suspense sales, they went under because like they couldn't effectively publish stories that like their audience expected from them because of the code. And so there was, and then like, I mean, I think with the big two, this is what led to stuff like, you know, the Adam West Batman series and stuff like that. Which was of course very popular and successful. And then, so it had kind of a, like, in some ways a positive effect industry-wise and others very negative. And it's a fascinating era to look at.
It's astounding what can happen with this idea, because you understand it's like, oh, well, we don't want government oversight, so let's overcorrect too much to where we don't need to have them there. So I understand, but at the same time, it's like, you know, keeping the coolness of the factor in there, you're not really doing that. But it's what comics had to do in order to survive to where we have them today. You can argue whether or not that compromise was ever a good thing, but it ended up working out in the end.
And I do like the little Easter egg in in the Spider-Verse movies, they start off with approved by the Comics Code Authority. So another thing that like adds to just like the, you know, those movies being such a like celebration of Spider-Man's history and culture, to have that as the little note at the beginning is really cool.
Oh, yes. Excellent. Yeah. So I'm going to go over some of the rules they had. These are not all the rules, because there's like 50 some. I think I'm going to do less than half of that.
When I looked at the outline earlier, I mean, like, I knew the gist of it, but looking at how specific some of these were, it just blew my mind.
So if there's anything in here, like as I'm reading through them, you want to have something to say, feel free to interrupt me, Kevin.
Sure. But
I'll start from the beginning.
Sure.
So first off, crimes shall never be presented in such a way as to create sympathy for the criminal, to promote distrust of the forces of law and justice, or to inspire others with a desire to imitate criminals. Okay.
That right off the bat. Yeah.
Starting strong.
Let's go through them and then I'll kind of like go through thoughts here. But yeah.
Okay. Yep. All right. Scenes of excessive violence shall be prohibited. Scenes of brutal torture, excessive and unnecessary knife and gunplay, physical agony, the gory and gruesome crime shall be eliminated. 3. Criminals shall not be presented so as to be rendered glamorous or to occupy a position which creates a desire for emulation. 4. Policemen and judges, government officials, and respected institutions shall never be presented in such a way as to create disrespect for established authority. So know the original Secret Empire arc where Richard Nixon turns out to be an evil person. He ends up shooting himself in Captain America, which would be for the loss if the Comics Code still had the way there. 5. All scenes of horror, excessive bloodshed, gory or gruesome crimes, depravity, lust, sadism, masochism shall not be permitted. 6. This is one of the most petty ones. No comic magazine shall use the words horror or terror in its title. Do you ever wonder why the name Strange Tales or Tales to Astonish what they did and still had horror stories and sci-fi stories? Because of this. 7. All lurid, unsavory, gruesome illustrations shall be eliminated. Very subjective.
I'm about to say, how do you, some of these parameters, like, how do you come to consensus for that?
Depends on who's rating the story, I suppose. 8. Inclusion of stories dealing with evil shall be used or shall be published only where the intent is to illustrate a moral issue, and in no case shall evil be presented alluringly, nor as to injure the sensibilities of the reader. 9.
Well, Infinity War would have never been made.
9. In every instance, good shall triumph over evil and the criminal punished for his misdeeds. 10. If crime is depicted, it shall be as a sordid and unpleasant activity. 11. Scenes dealing with or instruments associated with Walking Dead, torture, vampires and vampirism, ghouls, cannibalism, and werewolfism are prohibited. 12. Profanity, obscenity, smut, vulgarity, or words or symbols which have acquired undesirable meanings are forbidden. 13. Females shall be drawn realistically without exaggeration of any physical qualities. 14. Suggestive and salacious illustration or suggestive posture is unacceptable. 15. Nudity with meretricious purpose and salacious postures. Meretricious, by the way, is a word I had to look up earlier, so I learned something today. And I said I learned it, but then I completely forgot it as soon as I said I learned it. It means, apparently attractive, but having in reality no value or integrity.
Woo. Okay.
It's your $5 word of the day. And salacious posture shall not be permitted in the advertising of any product. Clothed figures shall never be presented in such a way as to be offensive or contrary to good taste or morals. 16. Nudity in any form is prohibited, as is indecent or undue exposure. 17. Illicit sex relations are neither to be tinted at nor portrayed. Rape scenes as well as sexual abnormalities are unacceptable. 18. Sex perversion or any inference to same is strictly forbidden. 19. Seduction and rape shall never be shown or suggested. 20. Profanity, obscenity, smut, vulgarity, or words or symbols which have acquired undesirable meanings are forbidden. 21. Special precautions to avoid references to physical afflictions or deformities shall be taken. 22, although slang and colloquialisms are acceptable, excessive use should be discouraged, and wherever possible, good grammar shall be employed. 23, ridicule or attack on any religious or racial group is never permissible. And I do think those last two were more recent additions. I think in 71, they had changed those. I think the original 21 I had here were, I'd have to look it up again. So, Kevin, that was a lot. Lay it on me. What do you think?
The good grammar thing, I think, is my favorite. So, like, no slang or anything. But no, again,
No slang. Just not excessive slang.
Okay, not excessive. Okay, got it. Okay. Yeah.
Do you love systematic ecology as much as I do? Of course you do. So why don't you hop on over to the Systematic Ecology shop and get yourself some merch. We have clothing like hats, extra soft t-shirts, sweaters, hoodies. We even have glassware and mugs. One of my favorite coffee mugs that I use every morning is a coffee mug that has on it, share the faith, share the geek. Yeah, I get my geek on first thing every morning thinking of systematic ecology. And I know you need to hop over there and get you some merch, represent us out in the wild, out in the public, and let people know that you too like to share the faith and share the geek.
But it's like when you look at it in full, it's because I knew about the, you know, they couldn't have horror titles or gore or anything like that or sex. But like when you get down to the minutia of everything that is laid out here, it is, I'm trying to picture myself being in a writer's room or in the, like with artists and creators at the time who are presented these lists and said, okay, now have at it, you know. What that was like to having to shift, and especially like we said, the people at like EC Comics where their bread and butter was horror and suspense, but yeah,
they were just neutered by this.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So it's, I don't know, it's wild, like looking at this and, you know, this is a significant moment in comics history and pop culture. Trying to think of how to start this. Like obviously some of these are just outright ridiculous. Some of them, again, tie back to what the intention here was of, okay, if there is problems with like linking comics at the time to like juvenile delinquency, okay, how can we make sure the stories are more age appropriate, because these are comics that are being sold on stands and places where kids can easily get to them, so you know, trying to make them more age appropriate. Okay, some of these, like reducing the amount of violence, sex, profanity, etc. Okay, that makes sense for you know, trying to like reduce that for younger readers. But as with everything with the Comics Code Authority, it's taken to a whole nother like overkill level in everything. I mean, some of these, you know, you just have to laugh at, you know, I'm gonna look at the list again. But, you know, I mean, I think my favorite is that like for a villain character, you can't have anything that would portray them with any kind of empathy. So like, you can't have Magneto, you can't have Lex Luthor even, or like any villain where the thing that makes them more interesting has to be taken away of. They just have to be very cartoonish, like 100% evil, and there's no real gray area there, which I find to be one of the most fascinating things in storytelling when it's done well, to have characters like you said, Magneto, Killmonger, others that like, okay, you see where they're coming from, you know, and like, yes, they do terrible things, but it makes the storytelling more interesting when you have a compelling antagonist like that. So that I think is probably one of the most ridiculous tenets of the Comics Code. But it is just fascinating that it lasted as long as it did, and you know, creators had to work with these conditions. But what are some of the things that strike you the most?
Yeah. So what you've said there, real quick, before I get to mine, could you imagine X-Men 2000 the movie is made, and it is Magneto of X-Men number one, where he attacks Cape Canaveral because he wants to mess with the space program and humanity, versus the one that is created by, you know, that is given more characterization by Chris Claremont as this person who is dealing with PTSD of having been in the concentration camp, wanting never again for it to happen, not only because he's Jewish, but also because he's a mutant. And all those intricacies you have, like, oh, I understand why he's doing this, instead of being here, haha, I'm Magneto, mustache twirling villain with the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. You know, those guys, they're surely going to be the good guys, right? Like, no. But it's just a staple of the times, the original Magneto. So when around that time is a little after the first time, I think, in Amazing Spider-Man 96 through 98, when they got rid of that temporarily for a bit, when they started being a little lenient on creators, not as harsh, so Magneto could come about as it was. But, like, I can't imagine a world where we have, as much as I love the older X-Men comics, the Magneto of then and the Magneto of now might as well be two very different people. Mm-hmm. So if we had maintained the comics code authority, we wouldn't have that nuanced character. We wouldn't have, you know, a Doom who is this benevolent dictator, but also a total and utter scumbag at the same time. Like, that you want to get away from that variant, but you also know at the same time he's probably one who can rule it the best. It's an interesting scenario that only cropped up because of the lack of anyone oversight saying, you can't have this, because he's got to be a mustache twirling villain. He's got to be so evil. No one should ever want to emulate Doom. No one should ever want to dress up as Doom for Comic-Con, is kind of what they're saying.
You wouldn't have the entirety of, like, the Sam Raimi Spider-Man trilogy, where most of the villains there are very much like, could have been a hero if, like, one thing had changed, or, you know, but yeah, that to me is, I like, when I first learned about the Comics Code Authority years ago, I didn't know that specific, and like, looking at that is just astounding. It's like, it's one thing to, yeah, want to censor materials and stories for the audience at the time, like being younger, but then to, like you said, just strip away any kind of opportunity for really nuanced storytelling is just, like, really reprehensible. So it's like, like you said earlier too, I think they made it so strict because they were trying to prevent any kind of government oversight, because there's no way the government could have, like, added anything more to this. I mean, it's as restrictive as possible. But yeah, I mean, it's fascinating too. Like, I guess on a, like, similar note, like, I don't know if you're familiar with the book or the movie Trumbo, about the screenwriter Dalton Trumbo. I don't know if you know that. Like, he was one of the blacklisted screenwriters in the during the Red Scare of McCarthyism and all that. And in the movie, he's played by Bryan Cranston. Both the book and movie are excellent, but that is also a really powerful. He won Oscars that he couldn't accept because he wrote under a pen name. So for, like, Spartacus and several other movies, like, he wasn't there at the Oscars. People didn't know he wrote those movies for the longest time because he was trying to evade government persecution. And so you see this throughout history. Yeah. So, like, you see this throughout history and entertainment and pop culture, where there are these, like, waves of scares politically that, you know, in turn limit the creative freedom of different writers, artists. And yeah, it's repeated itself multiple times. And of course, in comics, this is the biggest one. But yeah, that's where I think it's just some of the most things about this that are so egregious is just, like, okay, yes, we can look at the origins here and look at the intentions, but ultimately the massive restrictions here, I just, like, I can't imagine being a comic creator at the time working with these, like, because you're just so limited to anything you can tell. That's all you can do is tell very, like, mustache twirling villains with no nuance or characterization, and then the good guys always win. And I'm laughing too about those stuff, like, with, you know, characters can't be drawn, what, like, excessively or whatever. I'm like, that's like every superhero. They're always, like, you know, ridiculously muscular. And so, I mean, it's like, how do they even, like, adjust that aspect as well? It's just really funny.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that kind of sparked in my mind while we're having this conversation is, you know, like, the MPAA. It's not a perfect organization by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, after the 80s, it kind of got a little stricter on, you know, G, PG, PG-13, R, NC-17, yeah. X, all these things. But it's also incredibly useful at the same time, because, you know, if I'm a parent, which I'm not, but as someone who's worked with children, I would, you know, hey, I'd sometimes take them to go see a movie. And I need to know, okay, is this acceptable for them to watch? Mm-hmm. why, obviously the MPAA as it existed in the 80s doesn't exist in the 50s when this is happening, but like, why not create a system like that? You know, this is rated Y7. This is rated, you know, 7 through 11 or what have you. And this is rated definitely adult. No child. If you see a child trying to purchase this in a little dime store, don't let them. You know, like, it's that overcorrection out of fear that you don't think about the practical idea of what could have happened instead. And it's at that point, it's like, even if those were to end up in a child's hand after a point in time, you have a more, you know, gruesome horror story told in an EC kind of style. Well, the rating is on there. It's not our fault that a child picked that up. That is really someone else's fault. It's not a fault that, you know, a kid saw an R-rated slasher movie way too early for their own good. You know, like, it is clearly labeled for a certain group of people.
And I think
Go ahead.
Well, I think that's a great point. And I think it ties into how comics were sold back then versus now. Like I mentioned earlier, like, you get them off the racks and newspaper stands and stuff back in the day, whereas like comic shops today, like, I think about my comic book store, and, you know, everyone from adults to families to kids goes in there, and you can have the employees there when it, you know, if a family comes in and their kid, you know, just saw the latest superhero movie and they want to like start getting the comics, the employees can help them find, okay, easily accessible and age appropriate stories that they can get into. And I've never seen a kid sold, you know, Something Is Killing the Children or Saga or something like that. Comics, they're nicely rated. They have the mature rating right there. If it is, hard edge fantasy or horror comic that's meant more for adult readers. And so I think that's an easy solution. You think about comics today. Yeah, there are some that are very, very dark and gritty, and but they're not marketed to kids. Like, these are very much adult oriented. So I agree. I think a rating system is a much better way to address something like this versus just mandating that everything in this medium has to be censored to an extreme.
So I'll move from that as like the stuff I actually kind of agree with. Rape scenes, no go. Yeah. That is something. Right. I don't, it's not that it can never happen within a fictional medium. I'm not saying you can never write a scene like that, but it should be done in the way where this is explicitly evil. This is something that is, in a way, in some way, shape, or form, worse than murder or killing or something like that. It is a vile action. I don't want to see it portrayed on screen or drawn by someone. So that is a good rule. That's something that should be enforced a little more. Then we get to something like, you know, the female shall be drawn realistically without exaggeration of any physical qualities. That's been a huge debate for years from female comic fans, is that you have, I mean, there's a reason the trope, the most common superpower is that women have large breasts in comics. You may notice in a general population that doesn't always happen. But what entices little boys and men into looking at them, you make them a little curvier, give them the right figure. It's like, is that something that can just be eye candy? And definitely in the time of the 90s, when you had the bad girl trope was what sold a lot of books. You had your witch blades and Vampirella and all that. It's like the core premise, who cared what the Lady Death was about? You knew she was in a giant metal bikini or whatever, you know, Red Sonja was in a giant chainmail bikini. And therefore you saw a hot redhead with massive breasts. And therefore I'm going to buy it to see that. Yeah. There's something to be said there. And like, it's not that there should be no sexualization at all, because we are sexual beings, but there's a limit to that. There's a way to not just make a story based off, you're just going to buy this because you think she's hot. Like, give the woman a lot of character. And that's something that got neutered, especially early on. Well, and the times weren't ready to catch up, is that women were just kind of there. You had your extra female member of the team just to have a woman as a representation and as eye candy. You know, the Wasp early on wasn't the greatest member of the Avengers. The Invisible Girl was called the Invisible Girl as an adult, and later on would not take the Invisible Woman name until the 80s, after a lot of character development and growth. So there's something to be said about, should every woman be drawn the same way just to appeal to a male audience? No. But and the fact that you can't do it at all, I also disagree with that.
I'm glad you brought that up too, because that's the thing. I know it's easy for us to like go into all the ridiculous things about the Comics Code that like, we would never want this, you know, today. But absolutely, some of these, and this goes for other mediums as well, you know, where it's because some of the like excessive violence and sexualization becomes just, it's very excessive. And it almost, I think in some way, censorship like forces creators to be more creative, you know, and like, and not to rely on stuff like that just for when it has really no place there and it doesn't drive the story or anything. Because yeah, I totally agree. Stuff like that, like, I mean, especially the rape and everything, it means like, I don't want to see that in, you know, in anything, you know, I mean, and yeah, that shouldn't be, you know, in something that is meant to be an entertainment medium, you know? So that there yeah. are things to take away from this of like, okay, yeah, I agree with that. like that. But yeah, it's just really interesting to look at when you look at the nuances of, the like all the regulations here. Yeah, there are some positives to come out of it.
Yeah. You start off with a rule as well, and on another topic here they bring up, and it's like, policemen, judges, government officials, and respected institutions shall never be presented in such a way as to create disrespect for established authority. Yeah. That is such an obvious ploy to say, hey, government, you really shouldn't worry about us, the Comics Code Authority, because we're making sure no one's going to say you're a bad guy here. And look, like, hey, no government's perfect. No police organization is perfect. No judge is perfect. Like, everyone's got flaws. You know why? Because they're human beings. Imagine that.
But also,
Go ahead. They represent like, something.
Yeah, they represent, well, and also to, like, prevent any kind of criticism. Like, that's very problematic, especially because comics started very much as a social critique medium. I mean, you look at, we've talked about Superman multiple times on the show and how, you know, like, a lot of people that were villains, even in the early Superman stories, were authority figures that were corrupt. And so to prevent that really hinders a lot of marginalized voices, and it hinders a lot of people who are not saying like, you know, oh, down with all authority, but to question it and recognizing that like, no, there are corruption. There's a lot of corruption in world leaders and in, you know, whether it's like you're basic directly or you see it around society. So yeah, that I think was another rule there that was just like, okay, this is like, this in turn creates more of a like fascist mindset of, with, you know, the stories you're told to tell. If you can't, if they want to emphasize morality, then that should be also restricted to beyond just like, oh, superheroes fighting, you know, everyday criminals, but also they challenge authority figures who are corrupt. So yeah, that was when I looked at that role, I'm like, yeah, that's really problematic.
And it's at that point too, if this exists, we don't have Captain America Comics #1 where he's punching Hitler in the face.
Right.
We don't have the Secret Empire story, the original one, where Richard Nixon, in all but name, he's never named as such, but hey, he's in the Oval Office. I wonder who could be the secret leader of the Secret Empire who ends up, you know, committing suicide at the end rather than face charges. Well, it couldn't possibly be a man who was actually a crook in real life. You know, like, how dare we show that? Or we
have so many X-Men stories where it's politicians proposing laws to, you know, either like eliminate all mutants or arrest them, or a President Luther storyline or anything like that. There's so many that you just like have to take off the slate completely.
It's ridiculous. Like, once again, these institutions, they represent something. They represent something good. Now, not every member in them is going to be good. And if you present them as every member is good, you're failing massively because it's simply not true. But that doesn't mean the institution themselves is evil. It means there's something reform that needs to be made within them to prevent that evil from spreading. You got to stop racist cops from being a thing. While there's good cops over here doing their job, that doesn't mean they're both the same. And in the same way that there are politicians out there doing their jobs trying to protect their constituents, but a lot of the time it doesn't feel like they're hard. You know, you have to find a way to have that nuance there of like, not every person who I am against is evil. Like, there's a way around this. You know, not every Democrat in the world is someone who wants to take my Christian freedom away from me. That not every Republican in the world wants to create a fascist government where we ended up in a Handmaid's Tale. You know, it's there's a way to portray these things, and it's not by just saying nothing can possibly go wrong, and that's what it isn't. The opposite is everything is wrong. It's like, hey, there's the good and the bad. You have to portray both. You have to portray a we wouldn't have had the Spectacular Spider-Man story where Gene DeWolf is murdered by Stan Carter, who is the Sin Eater, who is a cop, who kills a good cop, who has been doing good work with Spider-Man and catching criminals and making sure the streets of New York are safe, because he's got this heightened sense of right and wrong where he has become evil without realizing it. Uh-huh. You know, that's a tremendously great story that we would lose if we had these rules in place.
Uh-huh. Oh, so, I totally agree. Yeah.
Yeah. So we said all this, like, does censorship actually have a purpose? Should it be a thing at all? Is it something that we should allow? Like, is there room for censorship in the world of comics?
So I think because of the points we hit on earlier, there is definitely room for it. I think, you know, the Comics Code Authority is an example of just like overhaul completely, where it's like limits. But like we were talking about earlier, where, you know, some of the things that came out of this of like, you know, not having rape scenes shown or like, you know, excessive violence for that's marketed to kids. Yeah, I mean, there and really, I mean, it's you think like, especially from a writer creator perspective, like, oh, down with censorship. You gotta give like creators complete freedom. Like, there's appeal to that, but also like an editorial board, that is censorship there. Like, when a creator hands in the work, they still have to go through a censorship process because you need another pair of eyes to look at. Okay, does this work? Does this work? You know, and give feedback. So, I mean, there's always going to be some level of censorship in publishing, unless you're self-publishing a comic completely, you know, and you can do whatever you want. But anytime you're working with a publisher, even Image or an independent one like that, you're still going to have some level of censorship that has to go through the editor and the publisher. And there's nothing wrong with that, because sometimes, like, you need a fresh pair of eyes to see what works and what doesn't, and if this scene needs to be there or not. So I think definitely there it should be some level, again, not to an extent of overhaul like this, because like we talked about earlier, I think there were good intentions behind the Comics Code Authority, even Subjection of the Innocent. Of course, I don't agree with like, but there were good intentions behind it. But there was like, it went into just a full black and white kind of thing without any nuance. And it was complete overhaul that was beyond any level of reasonable censorship. But to answer the question of like, is there a place for censorship at all? I think yes. I mean, it's just like, I obviously don't want too much and I want creators to have freedom. But you still have to go. I mean, I'm a writer too, and I have to go through, you know, editorial with my columns and with, you know, even when I'm writing a script, I send it to other people and get their feedback. And, you know, if a joke is there, like, does this work or does this not? What are your thoughts there? So, yeah, I mean, I think that's a question of, it's not a direct yes or no, but like, there's nuance there. But I think absolutely there should be some level of it. I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Christian.
No, I completely agree. It's not like it should be a blanket statement like they did with the Comic Code Authority. There's a time to censor. There's a time for you to let your creator be free. Uh-huh. Like, you know, I don't want a kid to open up. What was it? Was it Dark Reign, where Sentry pulls Ares in half and you see the blood and guts everywhere? Like, as an adult, I can handle that. As a child, they shouldn't be reading that. So Therefore, the censorship is a child. Hey, there's a rating here. Child should not be reading this. Or I don't want to see someone's head explode, you know, after they're being crushed or something. You know, if I'm reading a Power Pack comic or a younger Titans book written for kids, like, I don't want to see the villains end up in a manner like that. I don't want to see anything explicit. There's a time and a place for it. There's a time, like, Wonder Woman's origins is another reason why he had such a great, what's what I'm looking for here? He had a point to a certain extent. Her origins, I can't remember her creator's names. He was super into bondage, super into making women submissive. And part of that was creating Wonder Woman with her magic lasso. She would just end up in situations where she was just in bondage all the time. Hey, probably not the thing kids should be reading. I don't want to see your personal fetishes in this comic that a child is reading. Like, you know, as much as I love X-Men at times, you know, Claremont kind of gets his fetishes in there a little too much for my taste, but that's also at the point it's meant for a large, what's what I'm looking for here? Older reader. You know, it's not meant for little Timmy down the street who's picking up his first comic. That there's room for both to be there, for there to be a place where we can have these adult stories, but also have a place for children to read stories without fear of like, hey, what's happening, you know, to Batman, mommy? Oh, Bane's crushing his back, which could have been drawn in a worse fashion than it is in that original Nightfall. But it's good enough as it is to suggest what's happening without being overly gruesome or dramatic.
Well, and also, I know it's a whole other conversation, but it goes back to the stigma of like, oh, comics is a kid's medium. It's not, and it has never been. Strictly for kids. Just because it's a medium that has words and pictures does not mean, and like, is primarily known for superheroes. It is a medium, it's a visual, and like, within that, there are a multitude of genres, there's a multitude of audiences. Yes, there are plenty of comics that are geared toward kids, but there are also, you know, everything by Image and Dark Horse and so many books out there that are written, illustrated, like made for older readers because comics is a medium, not one genre, not one age-oriented medium. And so that's something to take into consideration here.
Yeah. So with that, I'm just going to go through a couple of examples of how, like, over the history of its presence in the comics medium, the Comics Code Authority had an effect on the comics. We've touched on this one before, but this is, at this point in time, William Gaines was one of the leaders of EC Comics, and he was unable to continue printing comics because of the rules they had, where we had, you know, crime suspense stories and The Vault of Horror and Tales from the Crypt. All of those had something inside of them that the Comics Code Authority said, oh, nope, we can't have a title like that. And we can't have covers like this, which, yeah, sure, why not, to some extent, depending on your audience. And because of this, they kind of folded. And we are extremely happy to have Providence on our side that we end up with the Tales from the Crypt TV series, which is pretty dang good. And the two movies that came out. But could you imagine a world where they were still around doing their thing if they had not been censored to this point?
On that note, though, did you know that EC Comics is making a return? I think it's this summer. I was actually reading it in New York Times, yes, like a couple weeks ago. I know Jason Aaron's one of the writers attached to it and several other big writers and artists. But it's 2024 and that's just happening.
And this is 60, 70 years removed from when that happened the first time. That's pretty sad that we could have had so many other stories they could have used along the way for great entertainment that were just neutered and murdered by the Comics Code Authority. Now, next up, we have a special story in a science fiction called Judgment Day. And the general premise is that there's this astronaut, you never see his face. And in the story, there are these blue robots and orange robots on this planet. And the astronaut, is a member of this galactic kind of federation thing. This is pre-Star Trek, where he's kind of like surmising to see if these aliens are going to be good enough to join them. And in the process, he learns that the blue robots and the orange robots, I think the blue robots are in subjugation. I'd have to look it up again. They're kind of almost like a slave race. And he's like, look. The orange robot he's talking to here in these panels is one of the only people on the orange robot side. It's like, hey, something's messed up. We should be doing something. He's like, yeah, the world needs more people like you, but you guys aren't ready. And the final panel, the reveal is in the 50s that the astronaut is black. And it was a huge, obvious cry against the racism of the day. But one of the leaders, I think it was a judge who was part of the CCA, tried to prevent this from being reprinted because he was a racist who objected to having a black protagonist. Completely missing the point of the story.
Yeah.
And the process. But after people complained enough, it was able to be reprinted. But could you imagine the inability to see that you're the bad guy here?
Right, right.
And the code doesn't prevent having a black protagonist. But he was using it to justify his racism because we can't have that. You know, it's going to cause an outcry or something like that.
Yeah.
Even though it had already been printed years before this.
That is a wild story. But yeah.
So there was that rule we mentioned earlier where you couldn't have these supernatural creatures like the Walking Dead or vampires or your Frankenstein's monsters and stuff. But in 71, they decided that since they taught things like Dracula in school, Frankenstein in school, the Lon Chaney werewolf movies were a thing in the public consciousness even then, that you could have those things. But you couldn't have zombies because they had no classical literature tied to their origins. Because imagine that racism they developed from a Haitian concept of voodoo. Therefore, we can't have zombies. But what we can have is when Wonder Man comes back to life, he's resurrected in Avengers 152 as a Zuvimbi, which is a zombie in all but name. It actually derives from a Robert E. Howard, he who wrote the original Conan stories, a term he put in one of his short stories. So they even said, oh, it's a precedence. It's a word. It's a classical story. So we can have a Zuvimbi, but we can't have a zombie.
And that's probably the most hilarious thing about it is like the alternatives they had to come up with for if they wanted a zombie or supernatural. They just like they couldn't call it that, but they could still have, you know, resurrections and magic. It just had to be, you know, depicted in a different way, which is, yeah, just kind of hilarious.
Why do you say that? I'm surprised there's not a rule against excessive magic use or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, because we're, you know, it's, I don't know. That's one of the things that boggles my mind too. Like, I mean, it's kind of unrelated. Well, sort of, but like, you know, in my generation growing up with like, overly conservative people that like wouldn't let their kids read Harry Potter or whatever, but then like we go to Disney World. I'm like, I mean, what's this? I don't know where you draw the line there in terms of like magic use, whatever. That's just one of the things that always like boggled me. But yeah.
Yeah. You can watch the Sorcerer's Stone and be like, oh, he's not using magic. Not really. He's a good guy.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Even though he ends up in a magic duel and it's a, right, but it's right. Okay because it's Disney.
Exactly. Exactly. I'm like, it's stories like this are always really funny in that regard.
Yeah. Then we have the beginning of the end. These are Amazing Spider-Man issues 96 through 98. A tremendously well-told story at the end of the day. I am like 80-some episodes away on Spidey Swing Vibes from covering it, but one day, 80 weeks from now, I'll probably get there. So what happens here is that there was an addendum added, I believe in 71, around the same time that rule changed, that you couldn't have narcotics or drug addiction shown in comics. Mm-hmm. Not even if it was in a negative fashion. Uh-huh. So the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare of the United States came to Stan Lee and said, look, there's a drug epidemic happening in this country. A lot of young people read comics. Can we have a story in your most popular character, Spider-Man, and have him confront someone who's suffering from the effects of drug addiction? Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And you can write it however you see fit. And Lee's like, yeah, sure. That makes a lot of sense to me. And starts writing the story, but the Comics Code Authority is afraid because we can't show drugs. Even if it means we're showing drugs in a negative light, drugs are still shown. That means children will want to see drugs and they'll want to do anything about it. It's like, you're not even paying attention to the story. It's once again, right, like falling flat in the face of what is attempting to be shown here. So in one of the most monumental moves in comics, Lee's like, sure. I mean, you can say you don't want us to have the story. You can say you want to kill it. I'm not putting that on my comic.
Right, right.
Which hadn't happened in 20 years. So as that happens, the story, people respond to it really well. Like, I think one of the officials who came to Lee is like, hey, like, you have done tremendous work here with this comic. We're totally grateful for everything you've done. And the CCA is like in shambles for a bit because they're like, they got away with this. They're not supposed to do that.
Right.
And then you have not too long after this, because I can't remember who said it. It was a writer at DC or an editor or something like that, who said that, you know, we're not going to stoop as low as Marvel to show drugs in our comics. And yet a couple months later, imagine this, what happens?
Green Lantern. Ask when Green that Arrow. Came out. Yeah. Yeah. Which is 85. A great story. Excellent yes. story here. But I was just thinking about that. I'm like, when did that come out? And yeah, it was right there.
It's not too long after this. This is where we find that Green Arrow's sidekick, Speedy, is a junkie. He is addicted to heroin. And it's something that has defined his character for many years in certain respects, sometimes too much, something he has long since gotten past. But yeah, with a bad writer, we'll come in and make it this thing again. So once again, showing it in a negative sense, showing there is an addictive quality to these things. It can ruin, if it can ruin a superhero's life, it can ruin your life. And like this comic series as well, Green Lantern, Green Arrow, was well known for its very progressive views on certain things and exploring them. Because you had like Hal Jordan was more like on the conservative side, and you had Green Arrow a little more liberal. And like the two of them, their ideologies kind of clashing together, which makes for some really good comics told well.
Right.
And kind of like realizing where they agreed, where they didn't agree was a lot of fun. And you have a great story like this that shows, hey, there are negative effects to it. It could happen to literally anyone.
Right.
You've got to be careful.
Well, that's the thing. You look at, I mean, just like that image is so iconic because it conveys Ollie's shock and disbelief as, you know, I mean, Roy being like a son to him, and he had no idea. And that's something that I think a lot of readers, you know, parents, other siblings or whatever who watched a loved one go through an addiction could empathize with. And I think it's why, you know, it's so important here. But that is, I mean, if you've not read that story before, it's cool. You can get the trade somewhere, but Denny O'Neil, Neil Adams, the all-time classic.
But even with this would not be the death knell of the CCA. It would continue existing far beyond when I thought it did. I thought for sure it was dead by the 90s.
Right.
Nope. It in fact lived up until 2011.
That blew my mind.
Right. I was like, there's no way. But another shocking fact is that in 2001, there was like an X-Force story or something like that. They didn't want Marvel to print. And like, dude, you are so irrelevant right now. It doesn't matter. We're just not going to put it on here anymore. And Marvel stopped sending their comics to the CCA in 2001.
Yeah.
And DC and Archie Comics did the same in 2011, 10 years later, which effectively killed it. So it is no longer in existence. It is defunct. It is an ex-Comics Code Authority.
That was the most interesting thing about its history, was that it was never really a matter of like, we just like, you know, got away with it. It just became less and less relevant over the years and just kind of more ignored. Whereas it was once, you know, strictly enforced, just gradually just kind of like disappeared into irrelevancy.
Yeah. And it was kind of a lame duck anyways, in that, you know, all those stories that came out in the 80s and 90s and even the 2000s, we're like, you didn't try and say anything about these. Oh, I guess because you're just weaker and this is just kind of like taken out behind the barn and shooting it.
Yeah.
Just it lived its time and now it's got a broken leg.
Yes. Right.
It's no good to us anymore.
It couldn't stand against, you know, Watchmen, Dark Knight Returns, Vertigo, any of that. You know, like, I mean, all of those came about.
Yeah. I mean, like the fact that we ever got the Dark Age of comics while the Comics Code Authority was still around is one of the things that took me for a ride. It's like they let these things be a thing. Well, I guess they really just didn't have the power they thought they did.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah. So this was super fun episode.
It was. It's so fascinating to look at all the history stuff here. And just where. But that was probably the biggest thing I learned is that it didn't officially end until 2011. That was wild.
Yeah, that's wild. I learned a lot through this. Like, I knew a little bit, but like actually researching this stuff, it's like, oh, okay, that's surprising.
Yeah.
Once again, that you lasted that long. I thought you were definitely dead in the 90s. Nope, still around. And I guess that's just me because I still, when I look at covers, I never look at that side of the cover. I just look at the cool stuff happening and then I go into the story. So there's that. Kevin, you have anything else you want to add before we start wrapping things up?
No, I think I'm right. I mean, this is a great discussion. And yeah, I mean, if you're a big buff, and there's so many more, this is only scratches the surface here. So, you know, there's plenty of research you can do if you want to learn more about this. But I appreciate anyone who listened to this. It's this was really fun.
Oh, most definitely. So as we're wrapping up, Kevin, what real life politician would enjoy your favorite movie?
I was thinking earlier, I said Peter O'Rourke, but because like, so first off, it's hard to pinpoint a favorite movie for me. It changes all the time. But one of my all-time favorites is Dazed and Confused. And I was thinking O'Rourke because like, he's one of the only Texas politicians I like. And I feel like with several others, Obama or Jimmy Carter, like at most, I think would really enjoy that movie. It's, I don't know if it ties into any of this, but I just thought of something that'd be like, oh, that would be fun to show to a politician if they haven't seen it.
Excellent choice there. As for me, like I said, I've answered this before, but I just happened to think about this while we were recording, so I'll actually answer the question. Did not. They're probably not in my top 25, 50 movies after all the movies I've watched before.
Yeah.
But like the Lord of the Rings movies, you know who would love them? Charlemagne. You know why Charlemagne would love the Lord of the Rings? Because his descendant, Christopher Lee, is in the movies and he's got to represent his family. So
Christopher Lee has the coolest, like, just cred ever. I mean, he was the inspiration for James Bond. He was the only cast member who ever met Tolkien. He has, I mean, related to Charlemagne. He's just, but that is a great answer. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That Charlemagne could use the Lord of the Rings in his life as he's ruling over the Holy Roman Empire. So after that, Kevin,
I agree.
You got a recommendation for the audience?
I was thinking about this. If you're into just like a pop culture, comics history, I really love the DC Year by Year, A Visual Chronicle. It's like this, you know, entire history of DC Comics specifically. And of course, it does go into the Comics Code Authority, but it just goes through year by year. So the edition I have goes, I've had it for a while. I got that book back in high school, so it predates New 52. But there's an updated edition that goes to that. Similarly, there's the Marvel Encyclopedia, but I'm a nerd for all of stuff like that. So if you want to go deeper into the actual comics history and look at, you know, what were the circumstances behind some of your favorite stories or creators, I think that's a really great book to go to.
Solid. I think for the purposes of this discussion, these don't have to be based on what we discussed, but since we already talked about it, if you haven't read Seduction of the Innocent, mm-hmm. and you want to understand like the feelings of the time, mm-hmm. and like how this could be a thing, I definitely recommend it. It's like, obviously I don't agree with everything that it has to say,
yeah.
but that's part of learning how to deal with things in life. Is like, I don't agree with this person. Why is that? Where are they coming from? Mm-hmm. And reading Seduction of the Innocent is a perfect way to do that as a big comics fan, to go, okay, I see where he's coming from. I couldn't possibly disagree more, but I get it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So guys, thank you for listening to this episode. Please get a chance to leave a 5-star review in your podcasting platform of choice. Also as well, join us on Patreon. And speaking of Patreon, we have some patrons we need to shout out today. If you want to be one of these people, you want to hear your voice spoken by one of the hosts, then please just head our way, join patreon.com/systematicgeekology. We are there for you. We have Russell Gentry, Justin Vaughn, Annette Knoll, and Jeannie Mattingly. Guys, thank you for everything that you do. Your support means the world to us. But remember, we are all a chosen people, a geekdom of priests.
If you'd like to support our show on Captivate, feel free to go to captivate.fm and find our show, subscribe. You'll get access to any future online D&D campaigns over there. You'll get an extra bonus question for 4 to 8 times a month. You'll get extra content like that through there. You also get a one-time donation you could make to help support the show right on Captivate. So you don't get anything for the one-time donation, but if you would like to just support the show once, do a quick donation, you can do that through captivate.fm. Our overhead includes editing software, marketing, equipment, recording software, and a whole lot of other stuff. And we really appreciate everybody who can help keep the lights on.
If you love our show, you can follow the whole network in a single feed on Spotify at Anazara Ministry Podcast or the network page on Apple Podcasts. There you'll find shows like The Homely, The Whole Church Podcast, My Seminary Life, Let Nothing Move You, Dummy for Theology, The Bible After Hours, as well as mine and my husband's show, The Clives, where my husband Taylor and I go through weekly discussions in a devotional conversational method to help us all get closer to one another and God.